And welcome to episode 10 or 110 of the Sober Butterfly podcast. I am your host, Needy Movina, and thank you so much for tuning in. You could be doing anything in the world right now, from, I don't know, texting your ex to fantasizing about your next. But here you are listening or watching, if you're on YouTube, the Sober Butterfly podcast. So thank you truly. So this week's episode, episode 10, is going to be all about what to expect when you quit drinking, because there are a lot of things that happen. Now, if you are sober curious, meaning that you are not sober, but you are curious about maybe quitting alcohol altogether, or maybe you're taking the approach of like forging a healthier relationship with alcohol, or you're just like over it, this is a great episode for you, because I'm going to walk through what to expect when you quit alcohol, and it takes a toll on many facets of your life, not just the physical, but also the mental, also the social. So I'll be diving into that. Now, if you are already sober, which a lot of my listeners are sober, maybe you can compare your first 30 days, 60 days, 3 months of sobriety with me as I go through the phases and my journey.
I've been sober for over a year, but I want to just do a throwback to the first 90 days of sobriety. And there's a reason, I think, why like programs such as AA will give you a chip for your 90 days. It's like a big deal. It's a big milestone. And it's not just because it's like, woo, you did it, 90 days, great, 3 months. It's also because I think that's where you start to see more long-lasting impact. Day one to day 90, you are really susceptible. You are really vulnerable in the sense that your body's undergoing so much change. There's, you know, psychological discomfort happening as well as physical, and your social life may change. There are so many things to expect, or expectation versus reality. I love those Instagram memes that I see, because it's true, right? Like, your expectation of something may be different from the actual reality, and everybody is different. Everybody's different. And so my experiences in the first 30 days of quitting alcohol may not be similar to some of the guests I've had on the episode, or it's to some of my listeners who are already sober. Quick life check-in before we jump into today's episode. I wanted to just share, I'm back in New York, back in the city, back at work, back to business. I had a blast. If you were listening to my like little summer journey, I went to Thailand and I did not want to come back. It was an adjustment. So this week's episode, I'm cutting it very close to my deadline. New episodes drop every Tuesday. So I try and record and get everything done by like 5 to 6 days, at least the recording done before my next episode. Let me tell you, today's Saturday. I am cutting it close. I have a 10-mile race tomorrow. But Tuesday, best believe by 6 a.m., it will be on Spotify. It will be on Apple. It will be on YouTube. It will be on any other streaming podcast service that you hear your podcast with. What to expect when you quit drinking the first 90 days. I will break this episode into three parts. Part one is going to open with the physical body impact or effects. Part two will dive into the psychological. And then part three will be all about the sociological impacts. Quick reminder, these are my personal experiences. I'm not a professional. I am not a doctor. Okay, I am not a doctor. By no means am I giving medical advice or anything like that. If you are thinking about not drinking anymore and you also feel that you drink excessively, you should definitely consult a doctor or a medical professional, since sometimes the unwanted alcohol withdrawal symptoms can be more powerful and lead to more dangerous outcomes than drinking at the rate that you're currently drinking. Messed up to say, but true. I know a lot of people that I've spoken to online or through the podcast or just in sober circles have mentioned that they had to take, for example, like benzos because they were having moderate to severe effects. So I didn't have to do any of that. But yeah, if you did, I would love to hear more about that. So just remember that if you go cold turkey and you experience things like shakes or cold sweats or anything like that, yeah, definitely talk to someone. Go to the hospital if you have to. My vision for this podcast has always been to uplift sobriety through the stories that I tell, through the people that I speak with. I don't want to like scare people, okay? Like, I'm not into fear mongering to get people sober or to like change their relationship with alcohol. I don't think that's as impactful as just uplifting people by example. So with that being said, as a society, we're doing pretty good, guys. Like, I think we recognize as a whole that drinking, especially in excess, is not good for you, period. Like, I think most people know that. Now, other people were still arguing that, like, oh, alcohol has healthy benefits and blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't think so. The science doesn't agree. But we're not going to go there right now. We're not going to go there. Instead, what I want people to know is that it hits your major organs, right? Like your liver and your heart and your pancreas. It also impacts your blood pressure, and it can lead to higher rates of cancer, stroke. What I don't hear mentioned as often, which is more so what I was experiencing, was related to violence, accidents, like the increased risk, even with suicide or suicidal ideation. It also can lead to weight gain and obesity. So the good news, though, like I said, I want to uplift people, not scare them. The good news is that by quitting alcohol or by significantly decreasing your intake of alcohol, you can drastically reverse these impacts, these negative impacts, like almost to the point where it's like you never drink at all, depending on your age and other like factors. But for the most part, you can reverse all of those years of negative binge drinking. And that's such a beautiful thing to me. Like, I don't think we give our bodies enough credit. Your body has a chance to recover from all of the harms of alcohol. Now, it's not going to happen overnight, and it's definitely not going to happen completely within the first 90 days. But some of the things that I experienced that really was notable that I'm going to share is sleep. I'll start with sleep because I'm a big advocate of sleeping, okay? Some people get hangry. I'm not like the most pleasant person to be around when I'm hungry, but do not cross me, okay? Do not even breathe wrong around me if I am sleep deprived. If I'm sleep deprived, I don't function, okay? I get sick really quickly. I snap. In fact, I don't even take naps because that's a tease for me. Like, I don't want to be teased with the prospect of slumber. I want to go to bed. With that being said, I really noticed immediately that my sleep improved. And it really comes down to quality versus quantity. And what I mean by that is when I was drinking a lot, I used to think that like I was sleeping well because I was like, oh, I got my 8 hours in last night. Like I slept. But y'all remember what it's like to pass out. Like passing out is not sleeping. It's not going to bed. Okay. It is the act of just being so drunk or drinking so much that you don't even remember going to sleep. So I would do that a lot. And I've talked about that in other episodes, namely like not having those routines. Having a nighttime routine wasn't a thing for me when I was drinking. On a good night, I would maybe like wash my face, brush my teeth. You know, I hear people talk about this. Like, it's not the greatest thing to admit, especially on air. But a lot of us who drink excessively did not brush our teeth at night. And that's not because we're dirty bitches. That's just because wine and toothpaste don't mix well together. So I had every intention of brushing my teeth before bed. I would drink before I brush my teeth because I didn't want to taint the taste of my wine or the alcohol. And then I would just get too drunk and I'd fall asleep. So yeah, if you think I'm a dirty bitch, whatever. I'm not. I promise you. I still have pearly whites. No cavities. Yeah, lucky on that front. But it's the truth, right? My skin, and that's moving into the next benefit. My skin was atrocious. When I tell you, I had late acne, like adult acne. About 2 years ago was when I really started to see my skin deteriorate. Because I was lucky in the sense that I just never had to deal with real breakouts, I didn't know how to handle that. Like, adult acne is terrible. Acne is terrible. But especially if you have no experience dealing with how to properly care for your skin, it just made it so much worse for me. And so when I quit drinking, I did see a benefit. Now, it was not overnight, like I said. Like, my skin is still improving. But now I am at a place where I can just put on a little, like, light loose powder and blush, lip gloss. Always got to have the brows done. And go. Before, I would have to cake my face up. Like, I would have to put, like, definitely use concealer. I could never go out the house without concealer. Foundation. Then my powder, my loose powder. And I was just, like, basically covering up all the blemishes, all the pimples. If I popped a pimple, the dark marks that were left behind. So yeah, it wasn't a very pleasant experience, but I was so insecure about how my skin looked. And once again, like, I didn't really have a routine when I was drinking, a nighttime routine, that is. So I'd be going to bed with makeup on, which is terrible for your skin, clogging my pores. And then the next morning, waking up with like makeup smeared pillow and like, damn, I did it again. And then washing my face, it was not a good look. Better skin is due to better hydration. And that's what was happening with me, because alcohol is a diuretic. Alcohol also dehydrates you. It's funny because when you drink, you pee so much. So I actually used to think in my crazy mind that, oh, I'm peeing a lot. That means like I'm detoxing. Like I'm getting all the alcohol out of my system because I've used the bathroom 10 times at this bar in a given like 3 hour span. I'm just like, wow, I never pee this much. This is actually good for my body. Wrong. Alcohol causes something called an antidiuretic hormone known as ADH. And so when you're drinking, those levels drop. And as a result, your kidneys have to produce more urine to retain less water. When you stop drinking alcohol, you restore those ADH levels to their natural state. And then your kidneys can expel the appropriate amount of water. So basically, by retaining water, you're staying more hydrated and your body will actually feel better and thank you for it later. Our bodies, we know, are like pretty much entirely made up of water. And every cell uses water in one way or another. So it's really essential for circulation, for maintaining your body temperature, and for helping your body get rid of waste. Without proper hydration, your heart has to work harder or pump the same amount of blood. So your kidneys will start to fail, which is why so many people that drink long-term have kidney failure. Something that I was not expecting when I quit drinking was weight gain. Now, I know that if you look at all of those like fluffy articles published by like Elle magazine or Cosmopolitan or like one of those like non-reputable scientific journals, you'll see information that suggests that when you quit drinking, one of the positive impacts is that you will lose weight. I don't like that. I don't like that that is usually not just mentioned, like an honorable mention, but people open with that. It's like one of the great benefits of a sober life. And even on sober Instagram, I sometimes have to cringe. I'm like, hey, you guys keep posting these before and afters where it's like you kind of look like a shapeless blob. And then a year later, you're like supermodel status with like these amazing Zoe Kravitz-esque cheekbones that are hollowed out. And I'm like, dude, like, that is not the reality for a lot of people. So let's just quit it, right? Like, let's stop opening with that. Like, it's great that you look better. That was not my experience. And maybe I sound bitter because I am, because that was very triggering for me in the beginning. And if I'm being real, a big part of me also, because I am a vain person, I do like how I look and I do put pride into my appearance. I knew I needed to quit drinking, not because I wanted to lose weight, but that was like, great. And ... I'm going to lose weight. And ... that did not happen. And ... it was actually the opposite. I gained weight. How much weight I gained, I have no clue, because I suffer from, I don't want to say suffer from, I hate being a victim, but I have disordered eating. So drinking, and I've talked in depth about this in episode 101 with a friend of mine, Faith Grant. I talked about this in episode 108 with Ketsia, around this idea that alcohol was a supplement for me, a nutritional supplement, which is really messed up to say, but it was. It was also how I was able to curb my appetite. And so I no longer could do that because I was no longer drinking, and therefore I was reaching for sugar. And I've always had somewhat of a sweet tooth, but when I tell you, it was unreal. Like, I could not get enough Oreos. I could not get enough powdered. I was buying like the powdered donuts. Like, who does that? Like the Entenmann's powdered donuts. Could not get enough. Like, I'm actually feeling sick about some of the ways in which I would gorge and then feel completely disgusted with myself afterwards. Let's talk a little bit about why that was happening, okay? From my understandings and from my research, because I really wanted to understand more about why this was happening to me. And it's because alcohol and sugar both boost our levels of dopamine. Now, for those who may not know what dopamine is, it is the reward chemical in our brains, okay? So it's basically triggered when you ingest alcohol, when you have sugar. It's triggering this feeling of pleasure, of euphoria. And so when we stop drinking, we might crave, and when I say we might, for me, I definitely craved sugar. And that sugar was to trigger that same dopamine release that I was getting on a consistent basis from alcohol. So it was like my body went into shock and it was like, oh my God, like, where's the alcohol? Like, what are you doing? And so instead I was like, oh, if I eat Oreo after Oreo after Oreo, I'm getting that hit, that release of dopamine. And so that sugar is released into the blood. When we don't have that, we, like I said, desire sugar in other forms. Now, also there's a psychological piece, and the psychological piece is if you've been using alcohol as like a treat or a little reward that you get at the end of the day or throughout the day, your body is conditioned or your mind is conditioned to find other treats and rewards to replace it. So then sugar often becomes an alcohol replacement, you know, after meals. So instead of like after dinner having a bottle of wine, you're like, oh, I'm just gonna have a whole, you guys are going to hear Oreos a lot because that's what I ate a lot of. I was going to say a whole sleeve of Oreos. So we always want as humans something to look forward to. So it's really integral to find other ways to reward yourself because sobriety is hard. You deserve a treat. What you don't deserve though is to feel sick because you've had too much sugar. That is a clear distinction that I want to make because that is something that I severely struggled with. I would rather tell you that upfront than lie to you with pretty fallacy of like becoming the next Bella Hadid or something because you quit drinking. Doesn't happen.
With that being said, those are the physiological or like physical impacts that I experienced within the first 90 or so days of me quitting alcohol. Let me know in the comments or write a review. Let me know if you experience any of those if you are sober. If you're not sober and you're thinking about getting sober, let me know what you're surprised by. Did any of that information that I shared with you shock you, surprise you, deter you? I hope not, but wanted to keep it as real as possible. Moving right along to part two of this episode, we're going to look at some of the psychological impacts, which I have a whole heap, okay? A lot of psychological stuff that happened to me during this time. I want to open this segment with the pink cloud effect, which is basically a stage of early addiction recovery that involves feelings of euphoria and elation. And so when you're in this phase, you feel confident and excited about recovery. The world is your oyster. Anything is possible. I picture like a girl frolicking through fields of marigold on a beautiful spring day with her like Yorkshire Terrier trotting behind her. I think like the very beginning of a relationship when everything is fresh and new and his little quirks don't annoy you yet. It's basically the honeymoon phase. You're like, well, what's wrong with that? That's great. I want to have a new perspective of life. I want to feel good. Here's the thing though, nothing lasts forever. And so sometimes when those pink clouds dissipate, it can be a really hard reality for people. And it's like, whoa, sobriety is not all rainbows and butterflies and puppies. Get me out of here. I can see how the pink cloud syndrome can have a negative impact on your recovery. The first month of my sobriety was not, I had no signs of the pink cloud syndrome, okay? Quite the opposite. It was like torrential storms, okay? I didn't feel euphoric. I didn't feel elated. I felt isolated. I felt numb in some regards. Well, numb and sensitive at the same time. Is that even possible? Like, that's how I felt though. The first like 2 weeks of sobriety, I was like, I'm not going to do anything. Now this was summer. So then I was like, summer's calling my name. I want to go out. I want to be in the streets. I'm still the same person. I can do all of the things that I used to do just without alcohol. That's what I thought. So I'm like, I'm going to brave it and go back into the world. I personally think that I have a good gauge on my emotions and I can regulate as appropriate. But during this stage of my sobriety, I felt like if somebody told me, like, for example, that they didn't like my nail color, I could cry. I was just so sensitive to everything. If you've never prioritized your mental health before this, now is the time. Because you may actually start to feel more anxious, more depressed, or if you struggle with other exacerbated mental health symptoms, they show up more. So for example, when I quit drinking, I had more free time more free time meant that I was thinking about things that I had never really given my brain a chance to really think about. Whoa, am I supposed to really never drink again for the rest of my life? Counting days, which can be anxiety inducing. The depression may seep in because now you may feel that you've lost a sense of your identity. I think it's super important that you prioritize staying mentally sober. So not just physically sober, not ingesting alcohol or whatever substance, but mentally sober as well. So some strategies that I recommend that I've actually tried, and I will give you some examples, are write in a journal. I know this sounds very elementary for some, like, okay, I'm going to get my pink fluffy pen out and write in a diary. Joke's on you. It works. Okay. When you're working towards mental sobriety or any type of sobriety, really, that could be physical, emotional, mental, spiritual, it's easier for you to get in touch with how you're truly feeling. Writing has been shown to provide a useful distraction, and that's especially when temptations or cravings arise. So my therapist recommended that I kept a trigger journal in those early days, and that was really helpful for me. Now, you know, we're on the go, so I wasn't always carrying around this like physical journal with me. Instead, what I did was on my phone, I just used the notes. I was just always constantly like typing away. Anytime I felt triggered by something because someone was walking too slowly in front of me, if someone really like pissed me off in any way and now I can't drink, I would just angrily, you know, type on my phone. It's also really helpful as a reflection tool. So I am obsessed with myself. And so I will go back and look at journals from days past. My earliest journal I have that I still kept is from 7th grade. If you look at that journal from 7th grade, it is incredible to like do an archival dive into your past. It is literally like chicken noodle soup for the deranged preteen soul. I also made sure that I was identifying my triggers. The journal aided with that.
Feel like crap. I feel annoyed. I feel pissed off. I feel sad. I feel neurotic.
It's one thing to be able to place that emotion, but then what is the underlying cause that's triggering that? So when you write about your feelings or your symptoms, you're also writing, or whether you realize it or not, consciously or subconsciously, you're also explaining what led you to this place of that particular feeling now.
The last thing I'm going to mention is creating a routine. I mentioned this, I touched on this in part one in terms of like me not having any routine, especially night routine when I was drinking, and that just leading to a whole host of issues in my life. It gives you purpose and it gives you structure and it helps you avoid large pockets of empty time, which is actually what can lead people to drink because you're like bored. If you don't have a job, maybe consider looking for one, even if it's just part-time or volunteer-based, just something to fill up your day. If you do have a job, service is also important, right? Like I have to find time to help other sober people. That is like my true focus. That's why I do this podcast. In that same breath, I'm just full of double entendres today. Like also try to avoid overscheduling yourself because that is easy to do as well. And in speaking to Ketsia in episode 108, she was explaining like overwhelming herself was actually one of the biggest triggers for her in terms of forcing her hand to drink. I don't like that expression, but go with it.
Here okay. We are with part three. So I'm going to open up about some of the sociological impacts drinking has on your social life. And I am the sober butterfly. I am a social butterfly, but I'm also that someone who likes to be alone. And that exists, that duality exists within me. And I'm sure it does within other people. Something I touched on in last week's episode when I was talking to Christina over at Sisters in Sobriety was this idea that I thought I was a lot more social than I actually was. And what I mean by that is drinking allowed me to create more of a facade or a persona that was this super outgoing wild child that didn't give a bleep about what anyone thought about me. And I was able to talk to all these different types of people, have no fear, throw it back. I'm talking about drinks here. And that was a total persona that I created. I had to relearn how to be social. Basically, I had to relearn how to talk to people. I realized that my default mode was actually I am anxious and I am awkward socially, and it does require courage to get up and speak to a stranger at a party. But courage does not mean liquid courage, and you can do it without a substance. So yeah, all of that had to be learned though. That did not happen even within the first 90 days. That's just me pointing that out from here. But let's go back to my storyline. First, isolated. Then I was like, boom, I'm going to go out. It's summer in New York. Let's do it. I'm on the scene again. So my therapist, like I mentioned in part two, recommended that I keep a trigger log. So it was like a journal that I had. I'm going to read for you an excerpt from day four of my sober, I guess, log, my trigger log. Okay, here we go. Day four. Today was tough. Fridays usually are. After a stressful day of meetings piled upon more meetings, I wanted nothing more than an ice-cold Prosecco to take the edge off. Or perhaps a deep burgundy wine to envelop me in warmth and comfort. Talk about romanticizing. Whoa! I resisted the urge and dared to push it to the ultimate edge. A freaking club. Chelsea Music Hall is for 25 and under. Oh my god, I do remember the site. Okay. I felt like an imposter auditioning for a high school vampire series. I have a friend, I'm not going to say her name, so I'll call her Brie. Brie had the goods as soon as I pulled up to her sweet haven on 22nd. Cocktail? No, I responded politely, secretly jealous of the foreshadowing events I could see so clearly. She was going to have more fun than me tonight. Indulge in a fantastical journey while I was plagued with reality. A grungy basement full of posers sloppily pushing into me. This way, that way. It was hard to keep track. Want some? Brie offered as she pulled out a vial of Coke with a different kind of red cap. Oh, I get it. No thanks, I responded, as least judgmental as I could muster. I tried to have a good time, or at least pretend to have a good time. If I wasn't doing sobriety, I would have done it all. If I wasn't doing sobriety well. That's how I used to call it, doing. I was doing sobriety. Anyway, there was an open bar after all. I could have tested all kinds of limits. Danced the night away. Flirted with all the boys. Spilled my free drinks in every which direction. Instead, I left early. I never leave early. And that's the end of day four. See, this is why journaling is so powerful. Like, I'm able to take a moment, take a pause. I remember that night. Immediately as I read those words, I was like, damn, yeah, I remember all of that. What I didn't remember, which is why I'm glad I kept a journal, is the internal monologue. Like, I can remember like the sequence of events. I remember like there was a free bar, open bar, and all of these things, and there were a lot of like industry people at this event, but I didn't remember how I was processing it. So that's why journaling is pretty freaking awesome. I am glad that I included this journal entry in the sociological impact and not in the psychological impact, because studies do show that your social relationships influence your substance use disorder recovery. There was a study done by the National Library of Medicine that I will link in the show notes below. I was astounded actually by this study, because in the study, it goes into individuals with a substance use disorder who have fewer social support network resources are more likely, like tenfold, more likely to return to substance abuse than those who don't. And the way I see it is like your network is your net worth, or vice versa, your net worth is your network. And I'm not talking about monetary gains here. I'm talking about emotional, physical sobriety here. Because if you are in a situation or a setting where people are maintaining positive relationships in relation to abstinence and engaging in self-agency to protect themselves from the influences of negative relationships, you are more likely to also be doing those things, as opposed to the inverse of that, which is if you're hanging around people who are partaking in drugs. In that story too, like, you know, like I went to a specific setting where there was an open bar, where my friend, you know, I went to pregame at her house without drinking, but like that probably wasn't the smartest move. You know, she's casually offering me, not pressuring me, but offering me, you know, drugs and alcohol. I said no, but I wanted to say yes. And that wasn't a good setting for someone like me to be in or place myself in, especially in early recovery. But even long term, if you're consistently hanging around people who are engaging in these types of illicit behaviors, the likelihood that one day you're going to have maybe a bad day or an off day is likely to occur. And then you're likely to probably say, well, forget it. Sure. Why not? Just for once. Putting that out there, like, it's really important for you to be mindful about the social network that you maintain and the people that you're keeping in that circle. A quick word of caution, your relationships are going to change. Don't expect things to be the same. A changed social life is actually, I think, a good thing. For me, it was a huge turning point, accepting that this is a big deal. As much as I was trying to minimize it in the beginning, it's a pretty big deal. And I can't brush it under the carpet. I don't want to anymore. But at that time, I was trying to just be like, oh yeah, and I'm sober. Accept me, love me, embrace me. That should be celebrated. Now, it's not always going to be celebrated for a number of reasons. Namely, people just might not accept that. And that's their right. Could be that by you admitting to them that you had a relationship that was poorly managed with alcohol, they themselves might also question if their relationship with alcohol is being mismanaged themselves. I went from being one of the most drunkest people at the party to being frequently the only sober person there. And so, of course, those things will be different. And that's not anything to shy away from or be afraid of. It's something to just know so that you can empower yourself and make better decisions for yourself. Okay, thank you guys so much for listening to this week's episode. If you have questions, by all means, feel free to reach out to me. You can follow me on Instagram at the period sober butterfly, or you can email me directly, hello@thesoberbutterfly.com. Just a quick request from you guys. If you are enjoying this episode or previous episodes of TSB Podcast, please leave a review. It is just super beneficial for me to help the show grow. I really would like to just also hear your feedback in general, so you can always reach out to me. New episodes drop every Tuesday by 6 a.m. So yeah, always stay tuned. Go ahead and hit follow so that you can stay abreast of new episodes and when they drop. I love you guys so much. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. And see you next week.